Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we have on Meredith Haberfeld. Meredith and I were introduced not too long ago by a mutual friend, and we just kind of hit it off. She's pretty amazing. I know you're going to really love today's episode. Meredith is a speaker and a coach, and she runs a company called Think Human. She has worked with companies like Spotify, Goldman Sachs, SoulCycle. She's been featured in media outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, CNN, and Forbes. What's really cool about Meredith is that she decided that consulting for companies was all about helping them understand with the right culture, companies can unleash the soul of the organization, impacting performance and ultimately the world at large. When I sat down to talk to Meredith, this wasn't just like a bio and she's not just talking about it. You could really tell right away that she deeply means it. We had an incredible conversation. I know you're going to love today's episode. She also is this awesome coach. I felt like I got some free coaching on the side and you get some great tips and thoughts to take home with you and hopefully impact your life as well. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, send me a note, laura@lauraco.com. I read all my emails for you, those of you who have. Thanks so much. I really appreciate hearing from all of you. And again, enjoy the show. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Meredith joining us. Hey, Meredith, how are you today?
I am really well, and I'm excited to be here.
I am so excited to be here. In fact, I wanted to share a very funny story with everyone listening today. Meredith and I were supposed to record a week ago. Was it a week ago?
That sounds right.
And we got on the call. We're all set to record. And Meredith was like, look, as much as I want to talk about this, I have this really cool new idea I'm really excited about. And I was thinking, why not run through it together? And maybe this could be a much more exciting, fun discussion to record at a later date. And so I jumped on it because I thought, I don't know, nobody's ever said that. It sounded awesome. And Think Human, the company that she owns and operates, is all about authenticity and craftsmanship and bringing that all together into what people do. And I thought, well, I also just want to hear what the latest thoughts were. So we ran through this this new idea that you just presented in California. Is that right?
That's right.
And I loved it. And so we're back and we're going to discuss it. So maybe you could just take a few minutes to walk the listeners through what this new idea is and what sort of sparked this, I think, next level of work in your career.
Yeah, I would love to. If I get on a rant and I don't stop talking, just interrupt me, okay? Because I could talk about this for a long time. So let's see. In my own experience in life, it seems like everybody I've ever met in some way wants to leave the world better than they found it. And I'm not saying we all do by any stretch of the imagination, but that we all want the world to be better. And in whatever ways we deeply care about. And we live in these like ridiculously amazing times where we actually can. Like proportionally, there's fewer deaths than ever before in human history. We have the technology and resources to provide food and water to all of humanity. We like 19-year-old, and I'm not saying we're doing that yet, but we have, like, we live in a time where we actually can. Mm-hmm. And there's this new kind of leader even that's emerging in the era where we live that is not just that traditional kind of inspiring movement leader like Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., but those leaders that stir our spirits, but this new kind of world-changing leader that's at the intersection of making the world better and profitable business, you know, the Elon Musks of the world or Richard Branson's or Oprah's. And the fact that that world is emerging, and it's not just, you know, these superstar business leaders that are doing this, but, you know, there's the 19-year-old kid who figured out the robot that cleans plastic out of the ocean. And we could go on and on, right? But we live at this amazing intersection of time.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that you're saying that too, because I feel like so much of the news and the media and everything is always focused on how terrible times are. And so it's very refreshing too. There are all these amazing people out there doing incredible things.
Yeah. And as you just said, we're living at a time where these amazing things are going on and the world has got a lot of painful, painful things happening in it. And, you know, on a, at the level of humanity and at the level of the planet. And so I'll come back to that in a moment, because that is had a lot to do with what had this new this thinking emerge for me. But you know, here we are at this intersection of we want to make the world better and we live at a time where we can, but we're human beings. And as human beings, there are forces in our humanity that help us with this endeavor, and there are forces of our humanity that get in the way. Like when the pressures of life weigh in on us in any way, we make funny choices. From the big macro funny slash bad choices that we make under stress, like you know, like the guys at DuPont who buried the research that that the chemicals were causing cancer to many thousands of people. You know, we can argue whether they're evil people by virtue of the actions that they took, but in my view, most of the people I've ever met who have made really bad choices are making mostly good choices a lot of other places, and then justify the weird choices that we make when under facing, you know, whether it's satisfying internal pressures of quarterly numbers, bosses, things that make sense in some weird context of, I know it's the not the right thing to do, but in the face of the pressures weighing in on me, it's what I feel like I have to do.
Yeah.
And it's not just external. I mean, I see it broadly in the world, but I also experience it very personally from the small compromises that I make myself under pressure, whether that's taking on clients in our company that I know are not a values match. And I justify it for, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, because, you know, it's covering overhead, or it's we're doing actually really good work for the people inside that company, even though I know that it's an integrity issue for me that the client is not a values match.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think I was just talking about this with a friend of mine who's a coach, and she came on the show and she said, you know, she looks for full body yeses in her life, like things where she just feels completely, completely like it matches her, you know, deepest sense of integrity. But she's, you know, we were just chatting that that's also just not how life always works. We are often saying yes when we mean no. And it is, like you said, a funny thing that we do that. And I think it mainly comes out when we're feeling stressed, when we feel we have to, or we justify it in some level.
Yeah. And yes, this is really funny. I don't know if you're a fan of Louis C.K. I don't even know if I say his name right, but the comedian.
I
know
love
him, right?
Him.
Yeah. Who doesn't love him? He's so amazing.
He's so funny.
Yes. And one of the things he does so magnificently is he takes aspects of what it is to be a human being and the ways that we can be such assholes and makes it funny in a way that we can see ourselves and laugh and be like, oh yes, right. So he does this shtick. I will definitely not do justice to it, but he talks about how, imagine you're in traffic and you're in the far, there's somebody in the far left lane who all of a sudden realizes that they want to make a right turn, and they like push their way through everybody's life and just, you know, there's like horn honking and man, they're just like moving on over. And then you look at them and they're like, I'm so sorry. I had to. You're
right. Like, it comes with that face that like,
yes,
like really, like, what do you want me to do face?
Yes, totally. Like, I'm so helpless. I know it's so terrible. I'm so sorry.
Right. And it's a helpless face. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, he does it so much more beautifully than I can. But he's like, yes, you're so helpless. You couldn't go up that one extra block and take 90 seconds out of your life to come around.
Right.
And he does it in such this magnificent way where you can see like, yeah, that's not just the other guy in traffic. That's me in all the ways that I do that, not necessarily in traffic, but in other parts of my life, make those, but I had to moments where it really looks like it and kind of feels like it until you really look at yourself and you're like, maybe I'm the asshole.
Like it's this kind of like, don't blame me. I don't have options. And so I'm just going to do the really obnoxious move. And I kind of know I'm doing it, but at the same time, I really don't want to be held accountable for it.
Yes. And, I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I ride my bike in New York City. That's like my main mode of transportation. And at times,
God bless you on that. That's crazy.
And at times, I take great pleasure in it, but at times, in order to navigate my way somewhere, I will do things like go the wrong way down a one-way street because it, you know, it would be like a big inconvenience for me to go the extra few blocks right. up to the, to go the right way. And I'm on a bike, so I can like pop in and out. Or I'll even sometimes, excuse me, if there's really big obstructions in the street, like a cobblestone street, which is not that fun to ride on, and then a giant truck in it, I'll even go up on the sidewalk when it looks like there's nobody there. And then all of a sudden people come on the sidewalk and I think to myself, can you please move? Can you not see that I'm on a bicycle? And it's so funny. I'm the one on the wrong way, yeah, going the wrong way down the street. I'm the one on the sidewalk. But in my mind, in my crazy mind in that moment, I'm like, move, what are you doing? Get out of my way.
Oh, completely. I mean, when you're the pedestrian, it's like all the cars are just completely wrong and everything they're doing. When you're driving, you're like, oh, these pedestrians and the bikers, right? Like whatever mode you're in, the other people are just like way in your way and driving you nuts.
Yes. And so, you know, that magnificent, majestic part of our humanity is what I then point to is that we want to leave the world better. And we really do. And we live in this world where we actually can, and not just the mega moguls of the world, but the everyday people. We have more access to technology and resources than ever before in human history. And we have our humanity that, you know, to contend with, that takes, you know, that has what we want when we want it in the moment, plus the stresses that weigh in on us that move our, you know, like move the needle from our true north to something different than that. And I don't actually take issue with that happens at all. I think being human in all its messiness is glorious. It's how we justify those decisions that then entrenches it, right?
And like the fact how far we go with it and for how long, wouldn't you say?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's one thing to do the moment on the bicycle and you're kind of like, you know, but what happens when it's year over year? What if you're running a huge corporation and to, you know, hit those quarterly numbers, you're doing things, you know, you shouldn't, you know, quarter over quarter over quarter and really affecting people's lives.
Yeah, that's right. And how we, like the justifications that we make to ourselves to have like to make it okay and kind of like the internal mental acrobatics, which, you know, it's not good for the world, but the bigger painful point from an individual point of view is it's not good for us as the human living inside our own skin, right? Like, it erodes our confidence and our sense of joy. And it all seems to be like what we have to do, but when we can kind of just get those little glimpses of what our own true north actually is and the world that we want to see, and the things that we have let get in the way of that, then we can take small, tiny, bite-sized, manageable, courageous risks to move back toward that true north. And that's really the point I was making in this talk in California, and the thing that's most exciting to me now.
I love how you just put that, courageous, brave steps towards our true north. Because really, why do you phrase it that way? I don't want to actually make the assumption. What is courageous about it? And what do you think somebody could do who's listening right now, thinking about, yeah, you know what? I am selling out to some degree, some places in my life. What does that mean to take a courageous next step?
Let's see. I think there are a few things to say about that. So one is that to make massive movements, I'm a big believer in Lego blocks, like one little piece, another little piece, another little piece. And that to try to take like big, gigantic leaps only leaves us feeling like too exposed and too vulnerable and oftentimes retracting back because like the move was too big to take at once. But by taking that small, courageous new step and not just justifying where we are, but like what's that one little incremental move that does actually feel risky and does actually take courage, but is small enough that I can, like a small enough bite of the apple that I can actually fit it inside and internalize it in a way that's okay. And like if I fail at it or it's disastrous for me, it's small enough that I can tolerate the feeling of that without retracting back completely.
Yeah.
You know, each one of those small moves builds something extraordinary. And similarly, I mean, that's like, I'm sure there's some, you know, old Confucius saying or something that says that much more eloquently than I did. But similarly, all the small steps we take away from that true north are just as profound. And so, you know, normally in our life, although there are times we make big integrity breaches, normally I think it's not that. It's the very small ways that we justify going unconscious to our values or the things that we actually see. And it's so human to do that. You know, I'm sorry, I'm going to kind of riff in a different direction here, but I've been looking these days at the news and what's happening in the world, and there are so many painful things happening. It's like a survival mechanism to just go unconscious to it or separate from it.
Yeah.
Versus like if we can take one small, manageable, courageous move toward being present to the world we want to see, and what small action can we take toward that versus just, you know, let me check out from it and turn on, you know, something that distracts me.
And you work with executives, entrepreneurs, and their teams to transform work and bring their authentic self into the work they do. What kinds of steps, what kinds of things do you recommend for people to do if they're listening? Are there some techniques you could share with us?
As it relates to bringing the needle back to true north or something else? Like what? Can you be more specific?
Yeah, for sure. So we were talking about, like bringing our authentic selves forward, taking those steps and taking micro steps. So say somebody is thinking they want to leave their job or they're at a job, but they want to take it to the next level. And they're thinking like, what micro step could it be? So for me, when I was working at changing my life, I wanted to see if I could write. And so the thing I did was I bought a MacBook and I sat down and I saw if I could write a page. Like it was just like such a simple thing, but that tiny micro step for me in as a writer was what got me started in the process. I didn't think about finishing a book. I didn't think about the New York Times bestseller list. It was just, can I even write a page and do I like writing a page?
Totally.
Yeah. So for, you know, the people out there who are in businesses working, looking to take their game to the next level or an entrepreneur, what kinds of things can they do to kind of bring that integrity into their work?
Mm-hmm. I think having an accountability partner in some way, it doesn't have to be a formal coach. It could be a peer. It could be a family member, but somebody who you make commitments to say, here's the thing that I will do. And I would like you to hold me accountable for this, because it's so automatic and unconscious for us to not do the thing that feels risky and that's not already in our habitual routines of comfort. And so having an accountability partner who we've said, like, I empower and embolden you to hold me to this one small action, whatever it is, and being willing to be called to the mat for it by that person and giving them giving them the reins to say, please do ask me how this is going and please do not accept my excuse for why I didn't do it or how I talked myself out of it, but hold me accountable for taking this one small step. And once I took it, ask me what's the next one I'm going to take.
I love that. I did not expect you to say that. And I think it's so powerful, but a lot of people, I think, don't get accountability partners because people can approach them in such strange ways. Like your partner has their own agenda for you and they start, you know, getting overly committed to your goals or whatever. Like they get a little militant. How do you suggest people do that without maybe destroying a friendship or ending up frustrated with each other?
Your point is a good one. People do bring their own agenda to it, especially in situations like family or spouses where it's like, oh, you actually doing that will make a big difference for me. So now I'm going to push you with my own agenda. Yes.
Yeah.
That can be problematic. So you have to be really thoughtful about who is a thought partner and somebody who can be a support and partner in crime who actually, am I allowed to curse? But I want to say who doesn't give a shit about whether you accomplish your goal or not, but who only cares that you get that you are held accountable to your own word and that that's the great thing about a partnership and that you then can do the same for them and that you just set the ground rule that your job is not to, you know, your job is not to push or force me. Your job is to remind me what I'm committed to and hold, you know, create the space that I step into that. And that when I don't, you give me the space to look into what got in my way so that I can clear that. And I'll do the same for you. And you set those ground rules.
at the start. And also you can set up, you know, we all have the ways that we know we are communicated with best, and being able to say, you know, here are the three questions to ask me when I don't keep my word to myself, or, you know, here's the way I want you to talk to me about it when I don't, because it's all easy and good to cheer for the person or cheer for each other when we do. Yeah. But, you know, like the trickier thing is, how do you have that conversation when somebody doesn't, and not have it just be the normal sellouts we do with our friends, where it's like, oh, I totally understand why you didn't do that. Come on, life is so busy. I get it. Kids, life. Yeah, me either. Let's go have a glass of wine.
Yeah, because people like to commiserate over the things they're not doing and not as much support each other in getting to the next step. Do you think that that's a piece of the challenge, is finding people around you who are really going to sort of get in your corner and not give you that, like, oh, it's okay, you know, I didn't get my stuff done either?
Is it a challenge? I would say, in my experience, and, you know, obviously I have the same limited human experience as the rest of us, but in my experience, we all can be prone to commiserate, and we all want somebody to hold us to be the, you know, higher version of ourselves. And that when you set that up with a friend or colleague to say, don't, you know, don't eat my BS for dinner and I won't eat yours. Okay.
Totally.
So I think once the ground rule is set in place, people actually rise to the occasion, because we want it. It's just not what's customary.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
And quite frankly, sometimes we don't want that from certain people in our lives. From some people in our lives, we just want to be able to go to them and go, yeah, I didn't do that. And I don't want to hear from you about it. You're not my accountability partner. So all I want you to do is hug me and tell me it's okay and that I'll do better next time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Usually family members in particular, that can be really tough.
Totally. Totally.
And you mentioned, you know, that we, to help us commit to the things that we care about. As somebody who's thought about coaching for a really long time, why do you think we make commitments to ourselves and break them so easily? I feel like I make 100 commitments a year that I just can, you know, on a dime, if I don't have the right support system in place, I can just drop. What do you feel like is the big challenge there in making the commitments to ourselves stick more?
I think that our ability to justify and have excuses to ourselves is like one of our great human superpowers. And
I love how you put that, by the way.
we're like ridiculously amazing at it. One of my favorite expressions, this is an old business partner of mine, used to joke with people who would say they'd love to work out, but they just haven't been able to get themselves out of bed in the morning. And she's like, even the words you choose, you can't get out of bed in the morning. That's so funny. You haven't been able to. She's like, are you like stapled to the bed? Like, really, you can't get out. You haven't been able to. That sounds so scary. I'm so sorry. You haven't been able to get out of bed. But, right, you know, like, we're, our ability to justify for ourselves that can't do something. I just can't do it. I haven't been able to. Instead of like, oh yeah, when the alarm clock, I mean, I'm just choosing a trite thing of exercising, you know, it's trite and not all at the same time, right? But, you know, with whatever thing it is, it's like, well, the alarm clock goes off. And instead of saying to ourselves like, oh yeah, I just turned it off and wasn't willing to make a different choice. And then we justify it. Like, to me, the justification is the thing to go into the tango with. And that when we get a different relationship to our justifications, then we can laugh at them and be like, oh, hello, I hear that justification and I'm not getting stopped by it. And that's where accountability partners, I think, come in so handy. You know, that's like the power of, if I stick with the fitness analogy, that's like the power of Weight Watchers, right? Is that you have to show up there week after week, and there are those people looking at you, and you're like, okay, I might not have done it for myself, but in order to look good in front of the group, I'm going to keep my promise. And, you know, and so take that to things that have some different form of gravity in our lives, whether that's, you know, professional development or taking risks in other forms or ways that we're committed to growing, being willing to look in full light of day at the justifications that we have that get in the way, and, you know, with play and humor, laugh at ourselves and have an accountability partner to say like, okay, great. That's so cute that stopped you today. Now what? I don't want to step over this really critical thing to me these days, which is, I think we can make a lot of commitments and goals in areas that don't actually stir our soul. And then we can even spend a huge amount of time being focused on growing them. And maybe this is a place actually that you and I like really potentially have connected deeply in the past, is that we spend time in our life really focused and motivated and working toward aggressively accomplishing goals that were not like the deepest, most important work for our lives. Maybe at that moment, you know, it was, I don't want to question whether it was the right or wrong thing to have done, but we can give a huge amount of energy and effort toward stuff that ultimately is not our own true north.
Yes.
And so I just don't want to step over the, you know, being at work and having an accountability partner and making commitments and being able to laugh at our justifications. All of that is important, but in the context of first being super connected to which direction the compass is pointing.
100%. I mean, this is one of the things that I feel like I, you know, want to tattoo and just on my forehead and walk around with. You know, we white knuckle our way through life and it's like, you know, work hard, you know, heads down is such a big phrase, right? Like, just push through, man up, all those different things. And I'm a big fan of working hard, but when you're working really hard into something that isn't really important to you and meaningful to you, it feels really heavy and it feels really hard. And so getting that compass pointed in the right direction, it's complicated because we've been taught to do it the opposite way. We've been taught that I'm going to point my compass in a direction that other people approve of, that culture approves of, that people have told me makes sense. And that's what, you know, really happened with me until I figured out how to point my own compass. It's not a class in high school. Point your compass 101. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, there's really not a great opportunity to learn that, which, you know, really brings me to this question for you. You're the CEO and founder of Think Human, and it's a boutique management consulting company that enables organizations, and this is what I love, to unleash soul in their business. I'm like, how many people put that in their company bio? How did that become your true north to say, I'm not going to just do a management consulting business. There's a lot of those out there, but I want one that unleashes soul into their company. I mean, that's such a cool thing. Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. Let's see. Should I talk about how, like, the path I walked to get there, or what it looks like in companies, or what?
Yeah. Well, A, like, what got you to that as a driving force? And then what does it even mean to unleash soul in their business? Because most people are like profit and loss statements and doing something with impact. But what do you mean by that?
So I started my professional life, or the very, very nascent moments of my professional life, as a scientist. I had studied neuroimmunology, which is a form of biochemistry, and let's just say biology if we boil it down. And I was looked out at the world and I was like, okay, do I want to run a lab? Do I want to go to med school? No, I don't want to do either of those things. And I decided what I wanted to do was do something that generally was helpful or good for the world. And I looked at nonprofits and I looked at government and I thought, you know, those seem to be like the do-gooder ways that I could do something. And I thought, I am like structurally, emotionally, psychologically not built for that. Like, I would just not do well, and it would not do well for me. And I also didn't see that those forms of change making were really some of the biggest drivers in the world. I thought, you know what, business is really compelling to me, and business, I knew nothing about it, nothing. But I thought, business seems to really understand how to move the chess pieces around the globe and produce results in the world. And I want to understand, like, as from a learning journey, I wanted to understand how to use business to make good things happen in the world. And we can talk more if you want about how, you know, my journey in business, which I found to be really illuminating and exciting. But back to unleashing soul in business, I had an incredible mentor early in my career who showed me that I ended up getting to be one of five executives, you know, by his side to build a $200 million marketing services firm in a very short amount of time. And we sold it. And he was an incredible, outrageous mentor for me in showing me that when you combine a good business model with people who are expressed and free and able to have transparent, messy, real conversations and getting to really thrive as human beings, that when you take human beings operating in that way, combined with a good business model, something quantum happens. And I got really switched on about the idea of bringing that more broadly to the world, both for what that makes possible inside of businesses and the human beings who get to work in them, but also for what those businesses can then go on to do in the world.
Very, very, very cool. So who was this mentor? Which business was that in?
That was in a business that now is called Transact, but at the time it was called Paradigm Direct. And his name is David Graff, a deep and important human being in my life who, lucky for me, I mean, he was my mentor 20 years ago, but lucky for me, he is still in my life.
That's amazing. And so this idea of taking people and allowing them to be free and express themselves, is that the part that you focus on now with companies when you go in and do consulting?
We focus in a variety of different ways. So in terms of this, I'm going to get boring for a second, but it'll get that more exciting right after that. The boring part is just the services that we provide, which is executive coaching, which we're working one-on-one with individuals. And then we do leadership development programs, and then we do consulting. I know that all sounds very boring, but in the leadership development programs and the one-on-one coaching, our orientation is toward human development, right? It's not like get to point X and check the box and now I'm a, you know, a great executive, or, you know, now I can get my next promotion. Not that those things are bad. That's awesome. Like, the next promotion feels good and, you know, helps us grow. But our orientation is toward growing as a human being to be the best version of ourselves and bringing all of our gifts to bear and to be able to bring that out in the other people that we are leading, so that we can not just be high performers ourselves and a high performing team, but create massive impact. So yes, working with people to be connected to themselves, be connected to each other, be interested in looking at our blind spots, being interested in getting feedback from others around us and making giving feedback safe, so that you're working in an environment where there's, I mean, that's a big buzzword these days, psychological safety in the workplace, but where you create a psychologically safe environment to have messy conversations and work through and resolve things, even if it's challenging, versus sweeping those things under the carpet, and creating an environment where we can give each other feedback so we can all be getting better and better, rather than just to tolerate, you know, to live in a world of tolerating things that don't work that well with one another. So that, from an individual point of view, the one-on-one coaching is where that unleashing soul starts to take place, where people get more and more expressed and free, and then able to like really do their best work at work and bring their own creativity and innovation to bear in a way that's really expressive and exciting. And from an organizational standpoint, setting up the environment and infrastructure and communication flow and core values and higher purpose, so that that kind of container is established and orienting people toward that kind of workplace.
Yeah, no, and for everybody listening out there, she's not kidding. Like, if you go to thinkhuman.com, I mean, the steps to the value system is, you know, be the renegade you are, take risks, be yourself, be free, lead with heart. I mean, these are not things that you typically see people engaging on in the business community. It's just amazing. So with that in mind, and that this is such a passion play and you're talking about this and making impact in companies, I ask everybody who comes on the show, what does an authentic life mean to you?
To be willing to laugh at what an asshole I can be, so that I have access to some higher, you know, version of myself, by being willing to look and see that and tell the truth about what I really want and long for and see for myself and the world.
Beautiful. I love it. And was your path to an authentic life? I know you started off in science and made a shift, but was it kind of, that was the turning point and you've been on that path since, or has it been something that you've been navigating a lot throughout?
Path to an authentic life. That's such a mind bender of an expression to me, because my own, yeah, man, I wouldn't say I live an authentic life. I would say I'm constantly awakening in every moment to like, oh, wow, I was just so asleep at the wheel 10 seconds ago, you know? So nice. I feel like my own experience of an authentic life is being able to see all the places ongoingly where I'm not being authentic or as true and awake to myself, and then, you know, truing myself back up. So that said, I do feel like there have been some key moments in my life, some of them really painful. 7 years ago, I mean, I could go back further and say, you know, there were many moments along the way that led me here. But 7 years ago, I had a terrible breakup with a former business partner of mine. It was like humbling to my knees. And we had been best friends. Our families were, you know, like my husband and her husband and their kids. You know, we would go on vacation together. We were the godparents of her kids. Our community was really intertwined. And our business divorce, we handled it just terribly badly. And that was, I mean, being humbled to my knees in that way by how painful that experience was, I had to kind of bring myself through the eye of the needle and rebuild my, get reconnected to myself and my value. I mean, I came out on the other side of that experience being so shaken to the core. And so I would say that experience was one key factor of getting connected to my own voice and being able to myself in the face of all that's incoming. And my first son, before I now have two kids, Ryan and Chloe, who are 7 and 5 respectively. Before Ryan, I had a son who died right when he was born. And, you know, it was a full perfect pregnancy, no issues. And then during the birth, something happened and he died right when he was born. And that experience also really just, you know, those painful moments, all of us as human beings, we know what that provides. And they either like flatten us to a point where we don't stand up as tall again, or we take ourselves, you know, through the eye of the needle to find a way to open our heart again. So I would say those two have been really pivotal for me.
Oh, I love it. I mean, this is why I wanted to ask, because as somebody who's been thinking so hard about authenticity, I mean, these answers are just, you know, so deeply thought through. And I agree with you. I think having an authentic life is an endless navigation. I think there sometimes is a turning point between a deeply inauthentic life and then, you know, coming to into the process of authenticity. But yeah, it's like almost every day you're trying to tap back into that authenticity to see if, you know, decision by decision, do I really want a latte or, you know, not. I mean, it almost feels like moment by moment, you're trying to keep
totally
connected. Yeah.
That's so true. And it is so subtle. I mean, you use the example of, do I want a latte? But I remember this moment where I had, this was met probably like about 10 years ago, where I first realized that, this is going to sound very hokey, but that my body was constantly talking to me, and that every time I was like, my body was full, like that I was done eating, there was like this minuscule little signal in my body and that I was done. And then I would just like push right past it and like, keep going and keep eating. Like, and I remember the first time I realized that, I was like, wow, like my body is constantly talking to me and I just ignore it and push it right back down.
Yeah.
And that whether it's in decisions about, you know, who we're dating or what work we're doing, or as something as basic as, you know, what we're eating, that we just push those signals down so automatically, even though they're there.
And we're born with them completely intact. I remember my son was really little and he had a nanny, and I came home early. I loved her. She was wonderful. No negative feelings there, but I walked in early and she had this massive plate of food for this 2-year-old. I mean, just massive. And he's sitting there just looking like drunk with food. He was just like, his face, his eyes, he was like, oh, you know. And I said, what are you doing? He's done. And she said, well, you know, the clean plate test, or the clean plate, whatever. And I said, well, are you a pediatric nutritionist? And she said, she looked at me like, screw you. But I'm like, if you didn't measure out the food for a 2-year-old, then how can you clean plate test the guy? But you're basically setting him up for a life of, you know, pushing past his natural understanding of where his body is, right? He's done eating. But, you know, we have like this tendency with adults to say, you know, let's ignore that and force feed the kid a little further. You know, it's just one of many, many, many examples where our body's natural intelligence is talking to us, and we, as a culture, don't train people to really listen. And I feel the process of coming back to all of that is such a challenge as an adult.
Totally. It's so, I mean, as you're talking, I have chills because as a parent, I probably do 100 things a week where that I'm unconscious to, you know, not necessarily about food, but, you know, where I just have my kids pushing past some internal signal of their own. And you saying that had me, I mean, it's not something I've thought of before, but just hearing you reflect that back, I'm like, wow, I really better check in more closely about where, you know, my kids are, as maybe yours too, but they're at such an age where they could take a potentially a different path to be able to hear themselves better. And there are ways that I do have my eye on that, but also go on just to it. So thanks for saying that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do it too all the time. It's in our training to push, push, push. And it's that balance between, right, we want to learn how to persevere and have resistance and resilience and grit. But
yeah,
that's not the same as overstepping your boundaries to the point that you're eating yourself sick, right? Like there's somewhere in there is the dance. And so do you have any habits or practices that you do on a daily basis, journaling, walking, anything to keep yourself grounded and you know, stay in your authentic space?
My favorite hobby is wandering. So whether that's in the mountains, in at the beach, in the woods, or through New York City, like any form of wandering for me is like reconnecting to the universe. So I fit that in as often and as much as I can, including my ways of biking around the city. Yeah, go ahead.
What do you mean? People always say walking. You just wander? You just get out of the house and say, I'm going to just go wander?
Yeah.
I love that. That's hysterical.
Yes.
Hey, so many people come on the show and say, I go walking, but I've never heard anybody say, I go wandering.
Yes. I think that wandering has like in some way, there's like a little bit more purposelessness to it. Like yeah. It's not I'm walking from somewhere to somewhere, but I'm just out taking in the world. And so that is, that's one. And I have a new meditation practice. I'm not very good at it, but it gives me great joy.
What's new about it? You mean just that you're meditating again, not.
And I've never been one to do a sitting meditation. I kind of developed my own weird form of, not weird, but my own form of meditation connecting to my breath while jogging. And so that for many years has been my meditative practice. Like I don't listen to music. I just am tuned into my breath and running. And that mm-hmm. has always been a source of grounding and happiness for me. And, you know, like, shifts any mood. But somebody pointed out to me that a sitting meditation is in fact different and provides something different. And I thought for a long time, many, many decades, I've been had talk about justifications and excuses. I found it agitating. And so I was like, I will just not do that. And finally, I said, I mean, I think thematically, this is more and more in the culture, but I just said, let me not try to take on a 20-minute sitting practice. How about I sit for 5?
Yeah.
I can manage 5. And in doing that, I was like, wow, that felt so good. And so, you know, to bring it back to the beginning of our conversation, that's those baby steps and building one small, tiny thing onto the next. And it's grown from there.
Yeah. Headspace is really great with that. It just, you know, starts you off at a really slow pace and dials it up slowly if you want, or you can stay at that same level. I know there's so much out there that you do 20 minutes to an hour and do a silent retreat. It's like, just start with 5.
Yeah.
You can get that going. Meredith, thank you so much for coming on today's show. This was so much fun, so insightful. You have such incredible things to share. If people want to find out more about you or your company, where can they find you?
Let's see. Think Human, you can find at think-human.com and Instagram at thinkhumankind.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yes, it's such a pleasure. So much fun to be with you.